wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Joining us in The Bunker today is writer Stephen Wyatt. Over a career that spans very nearly 50 years, he's written extensively for stage, radio and TV. But this is a Doctor Who podcast, so we know him best for 2 Seventh Doctor adventures, The Greatest Show in the Galaxy and Paradise Towers. It was through this latter story that Stephen came into the Cutaway Comics fold as he gave his blessing and input for our sequel, written by Sean Mason, Paradise Found. Stephen, hello and welcome to The Bunker.
Thank you.
So when I wrote the 50 years thing, I was going off your biog on your website, which had 1973 as your, I mean, you went, a play of yours with the Cambridge Footlights went to the Edinburgh Festival. Would you count your professional, that is your professional, first professional? Edinburgh can be both.
Well, yes, I mean, so certainly that's a difficult one. I think I would regard my professional career actually starting in 1977, which is my first earning money as a writer. But if that's the criterion.
Still 1977. That was a while ago.
It's still quite a long time ago.
It was a time in the when Doctor Who was Tom Baker and K-9 and Louise Jameson in if we date everything by Doctor Who time, that's what was going on then. So here we are in a format which, in a way, we've kind of broken with you, because you are a Doctor Who fan, but you're not a fan who can go, I can't decide which adventure to pick out of the many, many years. You're more of a casual fan who has written for it professionally. So I guess your first choice you've gone for is an Unearthly Child. So I mean, tell us a little bit about your childhood, and where were you in 1963? November 22nd, were you watching TV?
Well, I must have been. I would have been 15. I was still living at home and I was still at school. And I've only watched it once since, but I think Unearthly Child is, to me, really what Doctor Who is about, which is the idea of somebody with companions who gets into a phone box and goes places. That's all it was at that time, and it's a fabulous idea, and all the early adventures, a lot of the historical ones, which I loved. There's actually no Gallifrey, there's no Time Lords, all this stuff, which it acquired later on in a rather haphazard fashion, and at times has just taken over the series. To me, I just love the freedom that was there at the start. And when I first worked for Doctor Who, I mean, that was where I was coming from. And I was lucky to be working at a time at which it was felt that the series had got rather over-involved with Doctor Who mythology, and it was time for a bit of a change of direction. So I was there. But that's where my love of Doctor Who came from. And I just think it's a magical idea. You go into this garage, there is a phone box, and it goes somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason it's still going 60 years on. It's,
I mean, of course,
regeneration. Madman in a box, yes, all of time and space.
And it's interesting because if you look at Hartnell's performance, I mean, he's not particularly sympathetic at the start. He's quite a frightening, difficult, distant figure.
Mm.
Not remotely cuddly.
No, and it's weird the parallels, because having just watched Greatest Show in the Galaxy, which is one we'll come on to in more detail later, I'm reminded that Sylvester McCoy, A, that era being a sort of soft reboot, as in they didn't reference a lot of baggage. It was the Doctor and a companion in adventures, yeah, yeah, very deliberately, which is why it's such a good entry point for young fans at that time. A lot of people came on board for that Doctor, but he's not cuddly either, is he? He's quite a grumpy Doctor.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's right. I mean, because when I first started writing for Doctor Who, he hadn't been cast. So Paradise Towers was originally written for a generic Doctor Who.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, when Sylvester came on board, to a certain extent, it was possible to adapt it to him. But it was only really in Greatest Show in the Galaxy I could actually write a story for Sylvester.
Right, right, yeah. It
plays very much to his skills, to his clowning skills, the stuff I'd seen him do on the stage. And I think in the original Doctor I was writing was probably wordier than would have been actually right for Sylvester.
Mm.
There were just a few too many words.
Yeah, well, I suppose Colin Baker was a very wordy Doctor, wasn't he? I don't know if you'd sort of seen him in TV and had him in mind, or if you were just literally imagining.
It was completely a blank, absolutely a blank page. There was no instructions about him. And to be honest, not very much instructions about what Mel was about either.
No.
No. There was no real backstory to Mel. She was just Bonnie. And so it wasn't exactly the most, it's quite a strange place to start with, yeah, this blank canvas. I mean, the thing I liked about what we did with Sylvester at that point, you saying that he's quite a grumpy Doctor, but he's also quite he's very curious about things. He's, yeah, not a Doctor that charges in and says, get out of the way, I'm going to save the universe. We've only got 5 seconds. When he arrives in Paradise Towers, he actually says, oh, this is interesting. Tell me about this. What's going on here?
Yeah.
And that must be instinctively how I wrote him. Because I think it goes back to the original concept, which is much more, oh, we're here, what's this about?
Yeah.
Let's work out what the society is about and what's going on.
Yeah.
There seem to be quite a lot of episodes in which Doctor Who sort of clomped down the corridor saying, we've got only 5 minutes to save the universe or whatever. And they arrive, they barge into environments saying, I'm the Doctor and I'm going to sort it all out for you. And,
yeah, that sense of wonder of just exploring for the sake of exploring is, yeah, you're right, it's sometimes lost. I mean, it's funny, right at the beginning, William Hartnell, it was almost a character flaw. Curiosity killed the cat, you know, and he even puts his, in the Daleks, he even puts his companions in danger. That's how he was written in those days, by baking sabotage so that they could go and explore an irradiated planet. So it's amazing how this crazy show has sort of evolved in the past almost 60 years. But before you got the commission from John Nathan Turner, the producer of Doctor Who for Paradise Towers, I guess, as we've just established, you'd had 10 years of being a professional writer. So sort of sketch in what was your life post 1977, post that first official check for being a writer?
Okay, well, I was a lecturer in drama at Glasgow after I finished at university. Then I had a time as the writer researcher with the Coventry Theatre and Education team. And then after that, I various things happened. I had a disastrous West End flop called Aftershave, which was one of the first things that Cameron McIntosh ever produced. And I've started writing, I wrote for the Unicorn Children's Theatre, which is sort of getting me back on my feet. And then I started doing quite a lot of radio. And before Paradise Towers, the script was in existence, although it was only broadcast after Paradise Towers. I'd written my first TV play called Claws, which was about a power struggle in a cat club. And this is what I sent to John Nathan Turner, which he read and which Andrew Cartmell read. And in a way, was the appeal, particularly for Andrew, was he liked the script and he liked the humour, but it wasn't a science fiction script.
No.
I wasn't pitching, if you like, as a science fiction writer. I was pitching as, I like, this is some stuff I've done. I'd love to write a Doctor Who story. And I suppose even then I was thinking as a Doctor Who story, thing, hey, you can do anything in these stories.
Yeah, yeah.
And that sort of power of being able to create a world.
Yeah, there are some ideas that literally you can have ideas and they won't fit anywhere else, and then except maybe in a Doctor Who, because you can go anywhere. So how you said you weren't given much instruction in the sort of characters for that Paradise Towers script, but were you given instructions? Because people make a lot of talk about how Andrew Cartmell, how he sort of got his writers to read 2000 AD comics, like the Halo Jones in particular is one that's cited for Paradise Towers. I mean, were you aware of that side of things, the graphic novels? And
yeah, Andrew gave me a copy of Halo Jones, which I enjoyed, and it was probably the first graphic novel I'd read since I was probably about 15, actually.
Oh, must have blown your mind. It's one of my favourite things ever.
I liked it. I mean, the truth is about Paradise Towers is that it was written so fast, and we were ridiculously up against it. I looked at it. Andrew joined in mid-January, and we'd actually got the final scripts together by mid-February. Episode one, which I did a brief synopsis, was commissioned separately, and I think I did that in about, I think it was 7 or 8 days, I'm not sure. Got to the end of it, didn't know what the what was going to happen in episode two at all. I just thought it was a bloody good end to episode one and hope people would commission to find out. So it sort of worked. And then I wrote episodes 2, 3, and 4, first draft, in 6 days. And I always thought I was exaggerating about this, but if you go to the John Nathan production diaries, you realise that it was actually true. I delivered episode one on a Friday, and I delivered the other 3 episodes, first draft, the next Friday.
As a fellow writer, that gives me palpitations. I mean,
it gave me palpitations.
How much coffee did you consume?
I don't know. It was like a dream. It was like a mad dream. It really was. And of course, there was no time for synopses or anything. I just had to go with it. And in some ways, there's something to be said for it, because you really had no time to differ or say this is how to work. You just had to go, hell, let's just do it. And I mean, yeah, there is a side of thing that's quite good, I think.
I love Paradise Towers. It's an era, the whole that era. I was the age you were when you were watching An Unearthly Child. When that era came out, so I was going off Doctor Who. But I remember liking Paradise Towers because I think it. I definitely recognised Halo Jones, which was my favourite thing at the time, and still is. So it was to me as a getting jaded Doctor Who fan at 15, I liked Paradise Towers. And then looking back, it's still one of my favourites of that era, because so much of Doctor Who is about who you were when you watched that Doctor. So I'm very much stuck in the 70s. And then stuff after that, I can appreciate, but it's not in my, like Tom Baker is the Doctor, and I still haven't quite got over that. But yeah, I love Paradise Towers, and there is something about that chaotic energy, about like it's almost like you didn't know what was around the next corner sometimes? Did things just pop up?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it was an improvisation, you know. And I'm proud of the fact that when I delivered, all the episodes were actually pretty much the right length and the climaxes were never changed.
Mm.
If you told me that 6 days would still be discussed as a 35.
Well, I was about to say, I mean, God, can you imagine if you had any inkling during those 6 days, you just would have been paralyzed with fear.
Absolutely. I think there was that set. And I think the reasons why it was so crazy that at that point, I mean, Andrew built up a very impressive group of writers, some of whom had not written for television before. I was sort of out front because I was slightly older than the other writers. And I had written a TV play that was going to go out. So there was a sense, if anybody was going to do this ridiculous set of deadlines, it was going to be me. I mean, not that I thought about it in any competitive way, just retrospectively, that was what it was. You know, I was the only one they thought had a chance of delivering on this preposterous, crazy deadline.
I don't think they'd even be allowed to say you've got 6 days to do three episodes now. I don't think they'd be allowed. The writer's guild would be up in arms.
Yes, but also, you know, you'd have to have so many, I imagine that if it's like the other things that worked, and you'd have to have so many outlines and scene breakdowns and blah, blah, blah. By the time you get to writing, it's really rather boring. You know, if you spend too much time. Taking what you were saying about Halo Jones, you know, Andrew planted that idea. I mean, I can't say how much it actually went into what I wrote, because it, you know, the idea of the gangs being female was definitely Andrew's idea.
Yeah.
And was an excellent one. But the sort of actual gangs and their vocabulary and all that was mine.
Yeah, yeah.
So I sort of built on this idea, but it was a very good starting place, because I think it gives, it's another reason why the theory, that particular story has a feel of its own.
Yeah, no, and I think that's it's a lot of female representation, but also it kind of fed into your writer brain then, when, well, why are there lots of females in this thing? Oh, all the men have gone to war. And that sort of kickstarts really impressive world building, which you instinctively didn't rub our nose in. You didn't spoon feed us. It was just sort of there and worked and was very organic, which is another reason for the longevity of the, it feels like a real world.
It's one of the cheapest lines. I think it's Elizabeth Spriggs, one of the two children of Tabby and talking. They said something, well, I don't know. I think they went off to some war or other.
Yeah.
Like, such a long time. And that's it.
Yeah.
There's no further explanation, actually.
Yeah.
So there is something to be said. I like you. I mean, I think if anybody asked me to do that again, I would, particularly in my advanced years, I would go, oh my God, this is insane.
It gives me hives, as the Americans say, just thinking about it.
I was a lot younger. Two, there was no real choice. And, you know, three, we were cooking.
Yeah. No, and it's absolutely. I mean,
not all of it works. I never, you know, and I think particularly, I'm not sure there's no point in trying to think about rewriting it, but I think the Cragnon plot could have been better handled, actually. I think that doesn't really, I'm not sure that totally works.
No, something you've written in 6 days to be your final draft is mad, isn't it?
But it wasn't quite my final draft. I mean, there was work done on it afterwards, but basically the structures and the basic events were all there at that point.
Yeah.
You know, and the payoff of, you know, Pex getting killed, all that, that was always there.
Yeah, yeah. So how much were you on set?
Almost most of the time.
Oh, really? So that's quite a lot of writers don't get to be on set, especially in those days. It was very much a turnaround.
Well, it was partly, John was quite relaxed about this, and Andrew was learning. You know, Andrew was extraordinary. I mean, he sustained me with ideas, and we were both, you know, as it were, making it up as we went along. I mean, he'd only been in the job since mid-January, and here we were delivering a script by mid-February.
It is insane.
It's insane. And so he was very keen to be there, and he said, you should be there as well. So we both learned.
Yeah, but yeah.
Apart from the location shooting in the swimming pool, everything was studio, so it was all quite tight. It's comparatively easy. It's a bit more like radio. You're there in the box. You're not getting in the way on the ground.
No.
So you can sort of sit there at the back and watch what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, did you have much interaction with the legendary Richard Briers? That must have been quite absolutely lovely to hear that he'd been cast.
I worked with him a couple of times later. I probably got to know him a bit better then. I mean, you know, there wasn't time really to get to the again, I mean, the shooting schedules were insane as well. everything was insane. He's a lovely man, a very good actor. He was not my first choice. My first choice was actually T.P. McKenna.
Oh, I see. Who you got in for Greatest Show.
We got him for Greatest Show, but T.P. McKenna. And it would have been a less manic, rather more sinister, suave figure than Richard Briers, maybe.
Oh, I see.
I mean, Richard was very, very funny, and his handling of the end of episode one is magnificent. I think I share the doubts whether he quite got Caragnon right.
Mm.
Those scenes were done, I think they were the first scenes to be shot in the studio, and he had nothing to build up to. So he made a choice which is very pitched, very high.
Right.
Every time I met him, he used to say, well, they said I overacted on that, didn't they? But I didn't. he was obviously quite defensive about it. Because, I mean, as a comedian, he had almost perfect pitch.
Yeah.
You know, he couldn't get it wrong. So the idea that once he might have pitched something a bit over the top was actually quite worrying to him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean... Well, it's a funny thing with Doctor Who, as we've sort of touched upon, the fact that it's picked over by fans and critics, and people have written books about it, and people will watch those scenes probably more than... There's probably more eyeballs on Paradise Towers than anything else in Richard Briers' career. As the more we move away from his,
the good
his
life
career...
His yes, I mean, and he's probably, you know... Yes, and I think it's also because it's slightly outside his normal...
Yeah.
Range, those, you know, brilliant sitcoms and The Good Life.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God, he's an absolute legend to... For any of our overseas listeners who maybe don't know, he's an absolute sitcom legend. I mean, Ever Decreasing Circles and The Good Life especially. The Good Life was my childhood, in a way. My parents were the goods, and our neighbours were like the snooty Tories next door, and it was it felt like real life to me, The Good Life. Yeah, lots of mud and gardening and chickens.
I did a talking book with him. I did The Witches by Roald Dahl.
Oh, right.
And he was quite a nervous person in many ways. I mean, he made it look easy, but actually he worked bloody hard. Quite stumbly at various points in it. And we were coming up to the big speech by the chief witch, which goes on for pages.
Mm.
And quite stumbly, the engineer and I looked at each other and thought, oh God, what's this going to be like? He delivered it absolutely perfectly in one take. And we were on the floor laughing at it. We just didn't have to re-record anything. You know?
Oh, wow.
It just got there and it was brilliant.
Oh, well, I didn't expect to be talking about Roald Dahl audiobooks, but my seven-year-old son is absolutely mad on audiobooks. It's really taught him to read, and Roald Dahl, so he has the books and the audiobooks, and it's just got him into reading. But one of them he absolutely loves is that audiobook of The Witch.
Oh, the video, right?
Yeah, yeah. So he has the Alexa in his room, and so he just knows. We bought an Alexa and we don't use it, but the Alexa in his, so we moved it into his room and he just uses it to listen to audiobooks constantly and fill his head with stories. Oh. And he loves the Roald Dahl, and also for the Doctor Who fans, he has Genesis of the Daleks, the Terence Dix novelization, which he listens to on loop as well.
Warp Warp, the near legendary Doctor Who fanzine, is back for its fifth issue. As always, it's a sumptuous, glossy, gorgeous feast of goodness, featuring in-depth articles on all manner of Who-related expanded media. Artist John Ridgway and writer Steve Parkhouse discuss their classic Sixth Doctor comic strip, Voyager. And writer Alan Stevens takes us through the history of one of Marvel UK's most popular Whoniverse creations, Absalom Dak, Dalek Killer. There are two all-colour comic strips too, exclusively commissioned for Warp Warp. The Iron Legion returns in a 22-page story written by Lance Parkin and illustrated by Steve Andrew, this time pitting the rampaging Roman robots against the 12th Doctor, while Absalom Dak gets another adventure with the mighty John Ridgway on our duties.
Hey, Chainsaw Silversides!
On top of all of that, there's the full story of how Canadian animation studio Nelvana came very close to making an animated version of Doctor Who in the 1990s. As well as interviews with the project's key creatives, we've recorded the pilot script as an audio drama. Accompanying the magazine as a cover-mounted CD, it stars British sitcom legend Arthur Bostrom as the Doctor.
Endless vast wastelands, distant nothingness stretching as far as the eye can see. Not very inviting. Could be Milton Keynes. No, the stars are all wrong. Very wrong indeed.
Continuing our dedication to the printed form, Warp Warp 5 is only available as a physical copy and can be ordered from anywhere in the world for the UK price of £10.99 plus shipping. For more information and to place an order, visit warpwarp.co.uk. The link in this episode's notes will take you straight to the shop. Or, for our overseas readers going to Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles in February, the Cutaway Comics team will be there with piles of Warp Warp 5s for sale, as well as all our other comic book lines. So, see you in the dealer's room. And the bar.
We'll move on from Paradise Towers in a minute, but I love when I met you before and you had a photo. Was it Gallifrey 1 where some Kang suddenly accosted you?
Oh yeah, but actually I found them. There's a lot of cosplay at Gallifrey.
Yeah,
and it was the first time I'd been to a big event. I've been to small ones in England, not many. And I was walking through the sales room, whatever it's called, and I saw these two young women and I looked at them and I said, excuse me, are you Kangs? And they said, yes, we are. And I said, well, I wrote the Kangs, and so can we have a photo together? So they turned up with their five mates and we had photos together. Now, I mean, I think some people probably often meet versions of their characters, but this was the first time I'd ever met people playing characters in my stories.
I know, it's wonderful, isn't it? They're brilliant photos. There were red Kangs, weren't they? I think.
No, I'm blue. There were blue as well.
Oh, blue as well.
I think there were four red and three blue.
Oh, brilliant.
And they all warmed up by going, red can's the best, red can's the best. So, and then we had the photos. fantastic. No, it's very, very great. I loved it.
Brilliant. Paradise Tales, we haven't actually chosen as one of your official choices. But the official choice we've gone with is Paradise Found, which is the Cutaway Comics sequel to Paradise Towers, written by our own Sean Mason. I mean, how did you, when were you first approached by Gareth, our boss at Cutaway?
Quite a while before, you know, we met up and he showed me some of the work we've done and you've done. And I thought, well, this is great. And I mean, so I just sort of said, yes, because why not? And I could see the work from what he showed me. The work was going to be of very good quality. And I mean, I think you're quite kind to say how much I was involved. I read Sean's drafts and made a few suggestions about vocabulary and a few occasions, like I felt he was throwing things away or making things too complicated. But by and large, the work was entirely his. And what was nice for me was that I knew absolutely nothing about how a comic book was put together. So being consulted at stages, you know, watching Sean do his work and then Silvana Beltramo coming in and doing the graphics. And then I've forgotten his name, damn, the guy who did colouring.
Oh, Andrew Orton.
Coming, doing beautiful work.
Yeah.
And then Colin, was it doing the...
Colin Brockhurst, yeah, our amazing designer.
Fascinating to see, and you know, you could see it taking more and more shape with each with each person coming in, you know, and that was fascinating for me to watch.
It's
really just watching it, you know.
Comics take a long time to come together, don't they? That's the thing. I don't think people realise they're a disposable medium in lots of people's eyes, and they take a lot of work, a lot of people. I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, like a lot of theatre, theatre, TV, radio, there's a lot of people doing something that's consumed quite quickly.
You've done quite a lot, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I'm still relatively new on that side of things, so I've had to sort of learn on the job. But because I studied it as at university, and I'm a big comic fan, a lot of it was already ready to go in my head. So jumping into writing comics is you know, I found it quite comfortable. But I didn't have you giving me notes. I had Bob Baker giving me notes, the much missed Bob Baker, and you know, and that's. You know, I didn't begrudge that at all, obviously, because they were his intellectual properties. But also he really, you know, and it was also good because if he didn't like something, he let you know. Very occasionally, he'd say no. But it also meant when he said things were fine and he liked them, he really meant it. So it kind of gives all the stuff we've done based on his stuff that extra sort of quality control. It really does have his blessing. And he was a job, you know, he was still writing when he died. You know, he was a professional writer to the absolute last.
Let's hope we all can be.
Yeah. I don't think writers really retire, do they?
A friend of mine said you can't switch your brain off.
No, you've got to keep.
You may not be earning any money. Every idea you've got may be sent back. But you can't stop thinking.
No,
it really is as simple as that.
Yeah, I think you have a writer's brain, whether you're professional or not. So you have it as you're growing up, and then you get paid for it, and then maybe you stop getting paid for it, but you still have it, and you're still doing it anyway.
I think that's absolutely fair. I'd agree with that. And I mean, I think it's with the Paradise Found, and indeed when people have written stories about Paradise, I quite like it. I don't feel precious about it.
No. I mean, you wrote it in 6 days, so you know. every comma was there for a reason.
Yes, absolutely. But also because I don't know, I see it more as a compliment than not that people want to. I mean, if they did rip me off without asking my permission, I think that would be a different matter. But people said, look, we've got an idea built on it. Obviously, I want to know a bit about what it is. But then my view is, yep, go ahead. You know, I it's a sort of as I say, I'm happy for other people to play with the toys.
Yeah, I mean, that brings us neatly on to what we've sort of agreed is your third choice, which is some of it you've written, but some of it is other people writing it. And it's from the Obverse books. They have the Paradise Towers collection, which is Wall Scrawler, which is short stories set in that Paradise, set in Paradise Towers universe. And then there's the Black Archive, which sort of looks at Paradise Towers as a production. And then Build High for Happiness, which is another series of short stories. So I've not read any of these, but if you, I believe, Sean Mason has written one in Build High for Happiness, is that correct?
Yes, Build High for Happiness is a collection of short stories commissioned and edited by Stuart Douglas of Obverse Books. And I wrote one of the stories in it, and Sean and a number of other distinguished writers have contributed stories. So it's, and everybody's gone their own way, which is, again, rather interesting. I mean, they're not, there's nothing homogenous about the style or the way people treat it. I mean, I think Stuart has arranged it so people don't go too much over the same territory, you know. The Wall Scrawler is slightly different. The Wall Scrawler is all me. And in some ways, it's the thing I was most pleased that it came out last year. I mean, it's in three parts. The first part is six Doctor Who stories. Two of them about Greatest Show in the Galaxy, which were written especially for the volume. One which is out of Build High for Happiness, and the other three were commissioned by Gareth for Cutaway Comics, and I think the audio version is on its way at some point. But
that's where they come from.
Yes,
it's a big tangled web of projects and deadlines slowly shifting and obviously what's happened with Ukraine has sort of knocked everything sideways. So it's been,
Gareth having commissioned them gave permission for them to be published because. Which he didn't have to, because there had been so many delays. And then the second part of it is six stories based on the Old Testament, because during lockdown, I reread the Old Testament. Well, I read the Old Testament. I'd read bits before. I cut out some of it, like all the sections about the Gat and the
Angels. I was about to say, that's the bit they have in The Simpsons, that's just, he begat so-and-so and begat so-and-so.
And it actually goes on, there's a lot of it. But and there were a lot of extraordinary stories in there. And the one that got me going, the prophet Elisha is going through a village and the children appear in there and they start laughing at him because he has a bald head. And so Elisha curses them, and sea bears come out of the woods and eat all the children.
Sea bears?
She bears.
Oh, she bears.
Female bears.
Oh, not bears from the sea.
It's not what I ever got in my Bible classes.
No. She bears.
It's absolutely bizarre. I wrote six stories based on weirder bits of the Old Testament, which I was great to finally be able to get into print. And then the last part is short stories that I wrote for Radio 4, which have been performed by people. There were two which were done by Bernard Cribbins, one by Sean Phillips, one by Dora Bryan, and a couple of other stories. So it's sort of really gathering together all the short fiction I've ever done.
Oh, I see. So it's not just Paradise Towers universe at all. Oh, I see.
No, it's about a third of the book is Doctor Who. And obviously because of the, in terms of Obverse's books' profile, my selling point is that I'm a Doctor Who writer.
Yeah.
So that was prominently there, but it's actually about a third of the book. And several people have said that in many ways they find that the Bible story is more interesting. Some people like the stuff that I've written for radio better. It's a mixed bag, but it's everything I've ever done in the short fiction form.
Oh, well, I've been meaning to get a copy for ages, and I'll be putting a when I'll be putting a link in the show notes for the podcast.
I'll
go and follow it myself and buy the damn thing.
I would say that this is a cherished project.
Definitely. I love that Doctor Who is something people get into in childhood, and it does get people into things. Like, a lot of people will have bought your book, for instance, for the Doctor Who content and found themselves reading something they would never have read otherwise. And I think that's the same with Doctor Who across the board. It fires the imagination when you're young and then sets you off watching a whole load of stuff that's nothing to do with Doctor Who.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But the beginning of your journey was liking that as a child.
Yes. And I mean, absolutely. And I mean, as I say, I mean, my love of Doctor Who goes back a long way, although, you know, I'm not a strict fan in the sense that, as you said, I can't quote you. I mean, I've watched quite a lot of Doctor Who, but I dip in and out of it. So I'm not somebody who could tell you what happened in which story.
No. Well, it was interesting. You told me the other day that you watched a John Pertwee, for the first time. You'd never seen any John Pertwee.
Yes.
Do you know which one it was?
It was Peladon was the main title.
Oh, right. Yeah. There's two of those. So,
it's the first one.
The first one, yeah. With Joe Grant. Yeah.
Yes. Which I enjoyed because I think it was the point by which I was at the age I really wasn't interested in Doctor Who, and all this sort of sub-Avengers stuff that seemed to be going on really didn't appeal to me at all. And the idea of Doctor Who taking place in a unit on Earth seemed to be deeply... none of it turned me on, really.
No.
But I thought that I was surprised, actually, that John Pertwee was really a surprisingly straight Doctor Who. I always thought because he was always pictured with all the capes and stuff, that he rather camped it up as a sort of, you know, athletic superstar, but he was much straighter than that doing it, I thought.
Yeah, no, I think some people expect Austin Powers sort of
kind of thing.
And then you actually get the guy who was in the Navy being
absolutely. I mean, he's much more restrained than Tom Baker ever was.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's marvellous. So what did you... How did you come to be watching Peladon?
But it sounds a bit cheapskate, but at one point in lockdown, whatever it's called, the BBC streaming channel had an offer for a month that you could watch for a month.
BritBox, as was, yes.
BritBox, as was. And they had all the Doctor Who. So I'm afraid I went online for a month, had my free, and just sampled Doctor Who's that I'd never seen.
Oh, wow.
Which is quite a lot. I mean, I didn't get anywhere through the whole lot by any means, but there were a lot of stuff I'd never seen, or in the case of a few of them, like Unearthly Child, that I haven't seen since it went out. And so that was, so I tried to sample all the way through.
Oh, wow. What did you think of, did you genuinely enjoy watching the Peladon?
I did, actually, yes. I thought it was
one of my favourites.
It's a very well put together script. It's very well written. The acting is of a high standard. I thought it was good.
No, the whole Pertwee era, they had a really good budget and a really good sense of what the show was. And Pertwee was amazing. So he is brilliant. I mean, goes without saying, but he's a brilliant Doctor. The whole era is brilliant, but it's the first one it's the one before I was aware of Doctor Who. So it's the one I had to go back and watch.
Well, I had exactly the opposite, because I'd stopped, as it were, on Patrick Troughton.
Yes.
Really, my Doctor, actually. Yeah. I think he's still probably the best actor who's ever played Doctor Who. There's a sort of extraordinary depth to what he was doing.
Patrick Troughton, did you say?
Patrick Troughton, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was... I don't think he necessarily... He didn't seem to have great scripts most of the time.
Arguably. yes.
Well, I didn't see them all, but...
A lot of them are wiped, sadly, but yes.
Oh, I know. But I really like what he did, and I think, therefore, you know, probably another reason why I didn't particularly want to go into John Pertwee, you know.
Yeah, well, it's funny, because I was just interviewing Arthur Bostrom just a few days ago, and he he stopped watching, you know, Alpha Buster and From Allo Allo. And he stopped watching at exactly the same time and then came back for Tom Baker when he was at university. So everyone has a sort of cutoff point. I personally, after Peter Davison, went into Colin Baker and then Sylvester McCoy. That's when I guess I was still watching, but I wasn't. I was also being a teenager going, oh, God, it used to be better. It used to be better. Yeah.
That's always the theme, isn't it? That it used to be better.
Yeah. Well, that brings us on to I've got a big quote here on my notes. Greatest Show in the Galaxy, which I just finished watching, and I watched that on transmission in 1988 when I was 16, and I remember not liking it, but I must say rewatching it now, because it has got this amazing reputation. And it's absolutely brilliant. It's mad as a box of frogs, but it's absolutely brilliant. But you have your Whiz Kid fan character he's talking about The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. But he says, although I never got to see the early days, I know it's not as good as it used to be, but I'm still terribly interested. I mean, was that a deliberate dig at modern 80s Doctor Who, or how many times have you been asked this?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you what happened was, because the Greatest Show is exactly the opposite of Paradise Towers. We had arguably, I mean, it was commissioned, I was amazed to discover, pretty soon after Paradise Towers went out, John Nathan Turner said, let's get another script from Stephen. And we spent an awful lot of time going through different ideas. John wanted to do built round the Long Leap Doctor Who exhibition. Unfortunately, that didn't go very far, although that was the point at which it got called The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. You know, no pressure there. then we spent quite, Andrew and I, for quite a long time, spent time on what was going to be a three-part studio, which was about computer and computer games. It's still the idea of a contest. And one of the characters was called the Whiz Kid, because he was the one who was, you know, who was a brilliant computer nerd. And then things changed, and the series, we got onto a circus, and some of the characters, Nord the Vandal and Mags the Werewolf, carried over. And at some point during one of the drafts, I just made a sort of executive decision, because we had this character called the Whiz Kid. I thought, I'll make him a Doctor Who fan. and it was entirely my idea. John adored it. Andrew liked it. But you would think from fan commentary that it was the most significant thing that happened in the whole story. It's about sort of five lines, basically.
I know. Metatextual.
Metatextual, absolutely, I know. So that was why he was called the Whiz Kid, which is not the name you probably called the character if you're going to start from scratch.
No.
But that, and so it was, I say, we were probably quite lucky. I mean, The Greatest Show, I say, it was very protracted, and we'd sort of got a three-part studio going, and Andrew came in and said, well, John's decided it's going to be a four-episode story, and we're going to have one episode of Outside Broadcast, which on one level was fantastic, because it was more money, more opportunity. But then I thought, what the hell am I going to do? And so I made the decision in conversation with Andrew to put most of the OB work into the first episode that became about them getting there. And that's the point at which we created the character of Captain Cook to fill in, to fill out what was going on. So it was, I think we were quite lucky, given how many different forms and features it had, that it, I know it's quite weird, but it does actually make some sort of sense.
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, I've often heard lots of people, it's like amongst their favourite episode, and because it's not my era, I've always, you know, there's always, you know, there's lots of, I'm a bit like you in that I don't spend every waking moment watching Doctor Who as well. This is why this podcast is great, because it spurs me to fire up BritBox and watch these shows. So was Gian San Marco, you know, very famous for being Adrian Mole, the ultra nerd, was his casting sort of was that inspired by, because you wanted the nerdiest screen nerd. Is that why he got cast?
I had nothing to do with the casting, but I'm sure that was the thinking. So, I mean, as I say, I think we were very lucky because sometimes, you know, if a story's been going on that long, it gets clogged up with, you know, ideas you don't get rid of. Somehow or other, we're terribly lucky or maybe smart, I don't know, in that all the good ideas survived and all the crap ideas, not all, but most of the crap ideas disappeared as we went along. So there was sort of, there was a lot of weirdness about it, but it did somehow, it sort of held together, which given how long, given there was something like 7 or 8 different story breakdowns, exactly the opposite of Paradise Stuff, about 7 or 8 different story breakdowns for it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it
went on for nearly a year with all this, you know, and we were still, I think, we thought we'd got there, and then suddenly I was happy to take an extra episode, an extra money, but it was sort of like after we thought we sort of put the story to bed, as it were.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. And it's so 80s as well. You have a BMX, you've got the punk looking werewolf mags. And your chief clown is a brilliant invention. On your part, and then you were gifted with Ian Reddington, who's just, these are things I've heard from other fans that his performance is amazing, and it really is. He is kind of up there.
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, I would say the casting is, I would say, 100% perfect.
Yeah.
There's not a dub bit of casting in the whole thing from beginning to end, actually.
No.
The little point I always make about the chief clown is that, because sometimes fans say Ian Reddington's very fantastic even though he doesn't have many lines, and I always want to say, well, actually one of the reasons he was able to be so fantastic because he didn't have too many lines. Because actually when I was talking about the character of the chief clown, everybody else was thinking Ronald McDonald, sort of red-nosed, you know, bubbly clowns. Like no, when I went to the circus as a kid, there were these white-faced clowns in these beautiful spangly costumes, and they never got any shit on them at all. They just ordered everybody around. They were quite powerful, scary present, and that's what I want.
Yeah,
and when I wrote it, I was thinking, am I underwriting this character? And then I realized that actually I have this strong image of what he might look like. And you know, it's that thing of high status. The moment he said too much, he would lose his status as this strange white-faced figure. Yes. I mean, Ian was so inventive. I mean, I don't want for a moment to take away from what Ian did. I thought he was absolutely brilliant in the mad laugh and the gestures and everything. Oh, he's fantastic. But I sort of sometimes feel that people thought, well, he didn't have much to go on, did he really? So he just, and if you try to think of that script in with the chief clown making lots of long speeches about what he was about, what he was up to, it would have died.
I think a lot of non-writers don't really appreciate, they only see dialogue as writing, and they forget that writing a screenplay is everything. It's the beats, it's what you leave out, what you give to the actors.
And I think my favorite moment, I think, in all the Doctor and those two Doctor Who, still is the moment when the hearse drives up, the window winds down, and there is a white-faced clown in Undertaker's uniform.
I know, it's
I'm so pleased with that.
Yeah, well, you said to me on Twitter just yesterday that a friend of you were watching it with a friend of yours, and they asked you, what the hell were you on?
I wasn't actually on anything, but it was I think the other thing that's going on now, I've always been nuts about Fellini, so there's something about the clowns and what the clowns do which comes out of the Fellini world.
Yeah that makes sense. Yeah,
he does that. I think that's actually a very Fellini moment, a clown in an Undertaker's costume
Yeah, I mean, I love the surreal elements. It's absolutely, you know, stuff I just, you know, 16-year-old me just did not get at all. But it's absolutely, you know, absolutely looks just the things you put together and they work, just absolutely brilliant. I mean, my favorite scene. I've since found out talking to Gareth just this morning before we came on that my favorite scene is also Rob Shearman, the writer. You know, who wrote Dalek and many other things. He, I don't know if you know this, but he says the suicide by robot clown scene is like one of his absolute favorite scenes in the whole history of Doctor Who. It's absolutely insane.
absolutely. And I mean, and Chris Gard is terrific, actually. Everybody quite rightly goes on about in Reddington because it's, you know, it's a mesmeric performance. I mean, a lot of the other performances are very good. And Chris Gard's is excellent because he just takes the whole thing seriously.
Yeah.
You know, that is, you know, you feel that this character is somebody whose life has been destroyed and he has nothing else left. It's not Pam, actually, at all.
No. I think that's one thing that I appreciate now, having watched it, that I think as a kid I probably just went, "Oh, this is Doctor Who being silly," like when Horns of Nymon, which you might not have seen, a Tom Baker one, which you can just tell they are pissing their pants laughing while they're performing. It's like they're performing drunk because they are not taking it seriously. And lots of people love that episode because it's funny to watch. Tom Baker not taking it seriously, but ultimately I'm a bit insulted. You're getting paid to do this, play it straight, do it seriously. And I think that's what the whole Greatest Show in the Galaxy works so well, because it is people acting really well in a very surreal story. But, you know, but everything holds together as well. Like Bellboy kills himself, but he also, it's his robot that helps save the day at the end, and all this brilliant stuff. I mean, when you did have the script and you had, okay, here's the bit where he kills himself by activating all the robot clowns he's built, did no one say that might be a bit much for a children's program, or was everyone well into it being being that grim?
I don't remember there being any problems about that at all. I don't remember anybody questioning it.
No, I mean, I hate it when Doctor Who plays it safe either, because I think one of the things about Doctor Who is it should, if it's annoying the Mary Whitehouses of the world, it's thrilling the kids. That's its main job.
I mean, I think one of the nicest, you know, several people have said it's the scariest Doctor Who in years, and I take that as a huge compliment. And I mean, again, the class of the performance and the direction you get, you know, when Mags turns into the werewolf at the end of that. That actually, unlike many Doctor Who, that works. And it's comparatively, you know, simple technically, but the combination of how Alan shot it and how Jessica performs it, you know, it's in your face, you know, it's proper Doctor Who.
Yeah. Yeah. She's brilliant as well. She reappears in Doctor Who. As the Queen's voice in a new Who.
Yes. Well, she also, there's another sort of way in which, you know, Jessica's very important in my Doctor Who story, because she did three Mags the Werewolf stories for Big Finish. I wasn't involved, except to say yes and give me some money. well, they offered me money. I mean, who was going to say no? And then we went to Gallifrey. And, you know, we met up with the Big Finish people, and Jessica suddenly said, so why doesn't Stephen do a story for you about the origins of the Psychic Circus? And I thought, well, that's a good idea, Jessica. I mean, it wasn't my idea, really, and I'd never done any of that stuff. And the Big Finish people said, yes. And so that was the first Doctor Who writing, apart from probably a little note in, I'd done for 30 years. So it was sort of, I got back in, and Matt Fitton, who was my script editor, was, you know, really knew his stuff and was very, very good. So, but I think it also, thinking about the other. So thank you, Jessica. She got me back into all this in that way. And also, when you get back, and I think most people to do with Dublin who have that, but I haven't observed them so closely, there is a certain graciousness in how you handle fans.
Yeah.
Don't get up on your high horse and say, oh, I'm so-and-so, or don't bother me. No, if these people come and they want to talk to you, it's your job to be polite, to listen, and to answer questions that they have. You know, it's sort of... And I learned a lot of that from Jessica. The other thing I was going to say about it, which is interesting, because it's the only time I've ever had to interact with given Doctor Who characters. There wasn't going to be a companion. So they said the story has to involve the Master.
Mm-hmm.
It was the James Dreyfus version of the Master. And I, this was almost for me the most problematic thing, because suddenly I was having to use this established figure. And I kept on asking, well, what actually is the Master like? And all I could ever work out is he turned up and said, aha, Doctor Who, once you're going to be annihilated, ha ha. And then Doctor Who isn't annihilated, and that's it. And I find it quite difficult to find any way in, because it wasn't my character. Sylvester is the Doctor, that was fine. The other characters I'd either created or was recreating. And so I did have a bit of a problem with that part of it. That's why, although I made a few tentative discussions with Big Finish, I'm not really cut out for that, because a lot of Big Finish is about games within the worlds of Doctor Who. You know, what if the fifth Doctor met the seventh Doctor and the third companion and went off to fight the Cybermen or whatever? It's a very dense, elusive world.
Yeah, you do. You do have to really know your sort of the ins and outs of the of 60 years of this TV program.
Mark Platt, who obviously wrote for Sylvester as well. I mean, he has done a lot, and I mean, he's somebody who knows a lot about the Who work.
Yeah,
yeah. I won't say he lives and breathes it, but he does know a hell of a lot.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you! On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega El Tralla, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe, or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
So, famously, during The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, and I think this is another reason why it holds up so well, is because of the asbestos scare at the BBC, which meant you suddenly didn't have access to the studios. So John Nathan Turner had the absolute genius idea of, well, it's set in a big top. Let's put a big top in the car park at Elstree.
Yes. I mean, the idea, John made it happen. The idea was originally the designer, David Lasky, who should get the credit for...
Let the record show.
Yeah. No, I think... No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it was an interesting one, because the outside broadcast stuff on Greatest Show was really quite special. I mean, it had, everybody talks about it as being a rather remarkable time. Everybody got on. It was quite baking hot. We were there, I don't know, well, it was been 4 or 5 days, you know, and everybody was having a ball, presided over by TP, who was sort of, you know, as the elder statesman, was just great fun and very funny. And then, you know, it came to come back and, well, I wasn't told until the problem had been solved effectively, but, you know, there was potentially to, all this stuff was just going to be, you know, just chucked. And the BBC would happily have done it because they can claim on the insurance. So yes, all credit to John and to David Lasky for coming up with that solution, which, I mean, from an artistic point of view, is brilliant because it really feels like a circus and those billowing tent look like billowing tent tunnels because they were, as opposed to artificially billowing tent tunnels in a studio.
Yeah.
I mean, technically it was a nightmare because the sound, because it was in the car park, there were planes going over, there were vans coming in, there were lorries coming in, there were people going by. I mean, it was sometimes pretty tense, but from the artistic result,
yeah.
I think it came back to the fact that everybody felt that what had happened on location was really rather special. You know, and you could always find a group of people who were part of that to sit around and talk about it.
That's what comes across as well, is everyone's singing from the same hymn sheet. So it's not a surprise to find that it was a happy bunch of band of actors.
It was absolutely.
And again, you were on set a lot for that one as well, were you?
I was there for the entire time. I think I did all the studios. Yes, I was there pretty much all the time. I don't know whether that happened with previous Doctor Who writers. I mean, Andrew always sort of asked for the writer to be there. And I mean, I got on with John pretty well anyway. And I think he knew I understood the etiquette of these things.
Yeah.
You know, if I had a problem, I took it to Andrew and Andrew took it to John. And
yeah,
you know, it's like being in the radio recording studio. If you have a problem or you're worried about something, you take it to your director. You don't take it to the actors or anybody else.
No. Yeah,
you don't get confused chains of command.
I mean,
I don't really think I did have much of any. There wasn't much that worried me really in that particular.
Well, you'd had a year to work on this one.
As I say, that's not necessarily a great thing to do, you know.
No, I know from personal experience sometimes it's the crucible of a deadline fast approaching that makes you write the best stuff sometimes. And
because also, I mean, we have had a lot of dud ideas, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if I donate, I sell them to somebody for a donation to Oxfam, but so somebody holds them. But you go through the early drafts of this. You know, they're not scripts, they're sort of outlines, but three or four pages. And some of them you just get, this is terrible. And how on earth did we have to convince ourselves this is going to work?
Oh, God, yeah.
It's part of
the process, though, isn't it?
It is, but we were lucky, as I say, in that process, that the good bits stayed and the bad bits got lost. It can so easily be the other way around.
Yeah, but I'm happy to be a new convert to Greatest Show in the Galaxy.
Thank you.
There's a brilliant, I think I said to you when we were in Derby, that there's a brilliant podcast, which I'm always plugging on here now, Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, it's called.
Okay.
But they do, Rob Valentine, who writes for Big Finish, he's actually my director on stuff I'm writing at the moment, but he does an absolutely, I think you'd really like it, a really, really entertaining but intellectual analysis. It's a commentary, but it's absolutely, I'll send you the link, but I'll put the link on the show notes for our listeners as well. It's absolutely brilliant. So it's really good having listened to that and then watching it for the first time since transmission. Like all the, it'd be interesting to see, like, you're probably, like many writers, you'd be like, yeah, well, that's very nice that you saw that, but I wasn't intending that at all, but that's a happy accident. All this metatextual stuff and...
Well, it is an odd one, isn't it? Because we mentioned briefly that John Toon has done a monograph of about, you know, which takes it way beyond, obviously, just the day-to-day stuff. But, you know, sometimes he was sort of wanting to pin down influences of which I was clearly aware, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, well, it wasn't time to be thinking about. I mean, the one that drives me around the bend is High Rise.
For Paradise Towers, yeah.
So sick of people saying it's based on High Rise. And I'm happy to say, John Toon's book, he does a very careful analysis of the similarities and the way in which they are not the same.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, you know, you're talking about meta-text, you know, in that script, you could see, there was a whole potential gay context, you know, they're all single-sex groups, resis, and caretakers, and, I am on record, and I did say this, when John was worrying about the violence with the resis who were established as cannibals, and I did say, well, of course, John, you do realise they're also lesbians. And I said there's going to be this fun headline, Doctor Who in lesbian bondage cannibal horror. But, you know, like I say, I wasn't consciously putting this sort of subversion or subtext in, obviously because I'm gay, my sensibility is going to fill the thing. But, you know as well as I do, people don't go and smuggle subtexts in.
No.
Or have hidden agendas. They're concentrating on getting what they can as accurate and precise and vivid as they possibly can. And then it's up, other people can read into it what they will.
Yeah, and it also doesn't mean it's not actually there, because the subconscious does do a lot of...
No, I totally agree. And then the other one, which I also was trying to say, because, influences of previous Doctor Who's, blah, blah, influence of Gothic horror, blah, blah. And I said the primary inspiration was actually the world around me. I live 5 minutes for 35 years, 5 minutes from the two largest housing estates in Europe. You know, and I think it's not so clear with Greatest Show, obviously, what, you know, there's no direct influence in that way, but you are concentrating on getting the story, aren't you, and making that here. You're not thinking about... I think the WizKid is probably a very unusual example in that I knew exactly what I was doing, and it was a little extra frisson, and all the visitors had to have a different agenda, and we've got this character called the WizKid, and what was his agenda? And so I just said, hey, he's a fan. But that's how he got there. But I did know in that case, yeah, of course I knew.
I think some of the other things in Greatest Show, whether they're intentional or not, but it does, it's that we had high ideals at the beginning, that sort of doing the same show too often, that feels very real for a lot of actors I know. You maybe get typecast, or you get stuck in a show. And so was any of that conscious, or did that just sort of come out of the characters and the situation?
I think it came out of the characters, but it obviously was an underlying thing about, you know, how people in the 60s sailed out to the commercial pressures.
That's exactly what I thought. It was like, oh, it's all gone a bit corporate and we're still doing it. We're doing the shows at Vegas now, and it used to be real, and now we're at Vegas.
I was around quite a lot of, you know, community theatre and stuff in the... Interesting, I haven't really thought about this, but yeah, because I worked in Coventry Theatre and Education and did quite a lot of community stuff. So that must in a way have gone into... Not that I've had any particular in mind anybody who'd sold out or anything like that, but the way lives go, you know. Mm. But I hadn't thought about it before, but that must have been one of the things that fed into it, actually.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's a brilliant piece. I'm gonna watch it again and re-listen to that podcast again as well. It's absolutely brilliant. To come on to your final choice, talking of JNT, your final choice is a very quite a recent piece from you, which is Me, Him and Who. Was it him? Yeah, Me, Him and Who, isn't it?
Me and Him and Who.
Me and Him and Who. I never know if I'm putting too many ampersands in. Me and Him and Who, which is a brilliant audio drama about JNT and Gary and his partner Gary Downey, over several years. It's a fascinating piece, especially for Doctor Who fans. And it's quite a sad story, isn't it? I would say there's lots of joy in there and everything, but there's John Nathan Turner's alcoholism and Gary Downey having cancer. I mean, quite a challenge as a dramatist. I mean, you knew the guy, so how did the project come about?
Well, it was I was on holiday with my partner, and he said to me suddenly out of nowhere, "Why don't you do a one-man show about John Nathan Turner?" I thought, that's a very good idea. And Mark isn't particularly a Doctor Who fan at all. It was just must come to his head. And I thought, that's a good idea. So I went first of all, first stop, Richard Marston, who'd written the brilliant biography.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant biography.
Absolutely superb, who was was absolutely helpful and supportive throughout. And he said, no, I don't think anybody's doing that at the moment, and sort of gave me his blessing to proceed. And then I went to Barnaby Eaton Jones, who worked with, and I said, what about it? And with Barnaby worked out that it made much more sense as a two-hander. And then he got it commissioned by AUK, and then I wrote it, and then it got made. It was quite a difficult one in the way, because I did know quite well. My mum and dad lived in Saltdean, very close to where John and Gary lived. And so I knew them quite well during the post-Who years. The last years of John's life, after he was made redundant and was trying to get various projects off the ground in various ways, and basically the only things he could get off the ground were Who-related projects. And I used to go there when my mum and dad were around for tea and cake, and John would bake cakes, and he'd send a bit back for my mum and dad, very sweet man. And then at one point I went for what was supposed to be tea and cake, and it was just gin and vodka and orange, non-stop. I was actually ill, I just couldn't, and I said, could I have a cup of coffee? And I didn't. My mum and dad had moved by then, so I just managed to stagger onto a bus and get back home. So there was a real deterioration, and I mean, it was a difficult balance, because I liked John very much. I was very fond of him, and he was very supportive of me, both on the show and off. I didn't really know Gary that well. I think few did. And so I didn't want to... the last thing I wanted to do was a hatchet job, or a sort of what happened to Baby Jane, gothic horror version. On the other hand, one had to try and be truthful to what had happened, and that it is a very sad story.
Yeah.
So I just tried to balance the two, and I hope I've got something of the fact, they were in many ways quite courageous people, and they were very funny people. And, that counterbalances the, what is to say, basically a tragic story.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's absolutely brilliant. Because it's weird, when Richard Marston's book first came out, Gareth sort of said, well, what do you think about doing a JNT play or something? And I just went, I wasn't close enough to the era. It's like I said, it's not my era of Doctor Who. But then and one thing I did say was, it's very dark. So one of the problems I did think was, well, I mean, I think because it wasn't long since they did the sort of Adventures in Time and Space on the TV, which was the William Hartnell thing. Yeah. And I was thinking, well, even that's got quite a sad ending, but they sort of managed to make it. But I was thinking, but how would you do John Nathan Turner with everything that, the destination is that would be a real challenge. But it wasn't the right project for me at all to do. And then it makes absolute sense that you, who actually knew them, did this wonderful piece. But yeah, but that challenge of doing right by them, but without sugarcoating the negative sides.
I think one of the other things was that actually, because I didn't really connect very much with Gary, and a lot of people have this problem. They adore John, Gary, difficult and spiky, which I think he was. But actually writing the piece for the two of them required that you had to understand Gary as well. You had to understand what was the basis of the relationship.
Yeah.
Why they'd stayed together all those years. I'm sure John had never been short of people saying, John, why don't you get shot of Gary? He's not doing you any fair, etc. And they were obviously, it is a love story. And so I found I had to try and understand Gary much more than, and I, the one of the things I do remember from one of my visits, and I was chatting to John, and Gary came back from his counselling course. And along with a lot of people, I'd gone, Gary Downey, a counsellor, you know, one of the most, unbridled, tongued person you could possibly imagine. And I think what I realised was, because the dynamic between them had to a certain extent changed, because John had always been, you know, the alpha, hugely successful. And, you know, he was going downhill. And Gary was moving, a role of carer, it wasn't as simple as that, but that he was the support network. And I think going off to be a counsellor was part of his way of coping with what he had to look after John for.
So he was acquiring the skills required. So
he was learning the skills that he needed to cope. So that helped me to understand him, a lot of people, you know, lots of people found him difficult. You know, people did not warm to him. And, you know, he had this rather predatory attitude towards Doctor Who fans.
Yeah.
And stuff. So that was good. But as you know, you can't actually write particularly a play for two people unless you understand both of them.
No, I mean, it's absolutely, I've listened to it a couple of times now. It's absolutely brilliant. Really, really good. And I believe Gareth's going to stick a version of it on the stage.
That's what I'm hoping, with some, you know, we've done, worked on a reworked version, so it would be absolutely fantastic.
As far as I know, it's all going ahead.
Fingers crossed in this world. And he was realistic, because he did say if we went to Edinburgh, it'd be 2024, not 2023. So, I mean, if, but that makes a lot of, seems to me, a much more sort of sensible decision.
Yeah.
It would be great, because, I mean, theatre is where I came from. It's probably still my first love. But, and obviously an audio piece and a stage piece are, although there's an overlap, they're quite different pieces and quite different stuff, particularly in the ending. So, yes, I hope that happens. But it was very interesting to do. It was quite tricky to get the balance right, because, you know, using John's writing his memoirs was a way also of giving us the backstory at the same time, you know, because otherwise what you have is two people sitting there, nothing is working for them, and they're both getting ill and drinking themselves to death.
It works brilliantly.
Which is fundamentally the story, you know.
It works brilliantly, and we'll put a link for people to go and purchase it, which I would recommend they do. Looking to the future, and a version of it being in Edinburgh brings us full circle from 1973 to 2024.
My God.
That will be 51 years then. And it on in Edinburgh would be amazing.
And hopefully, it hasn't been for years. You go quite often, don't you?
I used to go as a film critic. And it was always my favourite festival, because it was at the same time as The Fringe. So it wasn't just boring old films. It was a million other things. And that probably got me into wanting to have my own plays on in. So probably very, very influential on my own life. But hopefully, I've got a Doctor Who one that Gareth's got me to do, about a Doctor Who fan who's got a model of K9 he talks to, which has been a long time in the making as well. So maybe we'll be on at the same time. 2024. Yeah. Well, I think that might be it might be happening. But yeah, it'd be great to return to Edinburgh. Anyway, it's been absolutely brilliant chatting to you, Stephen.
Thank you, yeah.
And pleasure as always to see you, either on screen or in the flesh. And I hope to see you in the real world at some point soon.
I agree. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Absolutely brilliant.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You have been listening to The Bonker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by Jane Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter @cutawayuk.